with some comments. And then proceed as before to open it up to the panel and then to the room.
Okay, Lee asked me to make a few remarks about the accounting perspective, and I'm happy to do that. And unfortunately, I don't have to defend why accounting deserves a seat at the table when diagnosing the causes of this economic crisis, exploring the solutions to it, and considering implications of the crisis for the science of economics. As some notable voices are claiming that accounting caused our current economic crisis, specifically mark-to-market accounting practices. if you noticed his slide, we'll get to that. Legislators and regulators in the US and the EU in particular, along with some such global groups as the G20, have focused on the role of accounting in creating and extending the crisis. And the US Congress has held some very fiery hearings in this regard. Further, academics are beginning to generate papers on the economic consequences of the Financial Accounting Standards Board, or FASB, our U.S. standard setters, mark-to-market accounting standards, and the pro-cyclicality of GAAP, which is generally accepted accounting principles as promulgated by the FASB. For example, just last month, two professors at the University of Chicago Law School posted a paper with the provocative title, Marking to Market, Can Accounting Rules Shake the Foundations of Capitalism? Part of the problem is that the FASB promulgated a new framework for determining and disclosing fair values that went into effect in 2007, just as the first big dominoes in this crisis, the mortgage banking companies, were starting to fall. The FASB standards require companies to prepare their financial statements when fair value applies, using the price that would be received to sell an asset or paid to transfer a liability in an orderly transaction between market participants at the date of the financial statement. That sounds pretty reasonable. But setting aside any conceptual issues that some of us have, as a practical matter, in inactive and illiquid markets, estimating fair values under the FASB's hierarchy based on assumptions that market participants would use in pricing an orderly transaction is one of the biggest challenges companies and auditors currently face. And guess what? Some of those Wall Street physicists who are looking for work have found employment with Big Four accounting firms providing audit support to estimate valuations using their quant models that some say helped get us into this trouble in the first place. As another piece of the puzzle, the FASB promulgated a second fair value standard, which gives companies an option to mark additional assets and liabilities to market. So we have the counterintuitive result of firms, including large investment banks, exercising this option and reporting gains as they become less creditworthy, accordingly getting to write down their debt. A third part of the problem is that one of the capital adequacy measures for financial institutions is based on GAAP. So the downward spiral in asset values under mark-to-market accounting rules, which often go well beyond declines in the expected future cash flows, likewise create a downward spiral in regulatory capital. Some argue that capital adequacy determination should not be based on GAAP. But in the US, Congress mandated this in the aftermath of the savings and loan crisis of the late 1980s. Specifically, the legislation does not permit banking regulators to use accounting rules for determining capital adequacy that are more lenient than GAAP. But stepping back from all this noise, it seemed to some of us that there's something much more fundamental afoot, of which mark-to-market accounting just represents the tip of the iceberg. Accounting is one of the essential ways we measure the activities of those who produce and exchange the goods and services in our economy. Until the FASB took over and the thinking of financial economists and capital market researchers began to dominate, accounting was largely based on capturing and measuring exchange transactions as they occur. To illustrate the importance of this point, let me pose a simple question that's one that I ask my students to consider at the start of their first accounting course or their introductory auditing class. And the question is, suppose you had the choice of preparing, using, or auditing financial statements based on actual transactions, expected transactions, or hypothetical transactions. Which seems to make the most sense to you? which makes the least sense? Which would you choose? Well, I suspect that, like my students, you'd most favor actual transactions and least favor hypothetical transactions. Although you, like some students, especially auditing students, might suggest substituting expected transactions for actual when necessary to avoid overstating assets, understating liabilities, and overstating earnings, a la lower of cost or market and conservative accounting. So this simple question juxtaposes intuition and common sense with the current direction of accounting standard setters, which embraces hypotheticals. Sources, including the media, who describe mark-to-market accounting as capturing reality, as if there was such a thing, have completely missed the paradox that instead it's based on hypotheticals. Anyway, some time ago, before the current economic crisis began to unfold, a few of us accountants were concerned enough about the direction of the standard setters that we decided to get back to basics, to better understand our field. And since there's nothing more basic than debits, credits, and the accounting equation, that's where we started. While most accountants take these for granted, non-accountants seem to consider the accounting equation as something very special when it comes to bridging space and time in our econosphere. In fact, techno-thinkers polled by John Brockman at the turn of this century considered double-entry accounting as to be one of mankind's top 10 inventions, and they described it as the DOS of money. And this powerful statement gets right to the foundational issues that elude us accountants. For example, I can't recall one article in an accounting journal that explores the connection between accounting and money, although we're living through an economic crisis that begs for understanding this connection. And interestingly, a few others outside accounting have pursued the money side, including the time-money connection, and they draw on fields such as physics to do so, such as the work of Per Bach on the dynamics of money that Lee alluded to or talked about this morning. Anyway, to conclude, count me in as one who's convinced that it's essential for accounting scholars to draw on fields outside the social sciences to address foundational issues in accounting, in order to understand, for example, why mark-to-market accounting seems to be tearing apart the fabric of our system for measuring the intrinsic cycles of our economic activities, and in the process, contributing to the very current and deep economic crisis.
So I hadn't quite intended to begin this way, but I guess I have to begin as a footnote to Zoe Venn, because the essential content that I became immersed in, that I imbibed and internalized during the short decade from when I left Cambridge with a doctorate on the from the crash of 29 to the depression of 31, 33, what I spent my time learning was that there was something actually more fundamental than the accounting equation, cash. And that the process through which I migrated from academic economics and political economy to venture capital was by learning how to follow the cash. And so the comments about Per Bach, and which actually has an echo to my Cambridge-trained mind because of the inaugural lecture that Frank Hahn gave as professor of economics, as the successor to my mentor, Richard Kahn, who in the apostolic succession was Keynes's leading student. Frank Hahn's lecture was about if indeed we take seriously Arrow de Bruyne, what do we do about money? Money is overhead. Money is an inefficiency in a complete and efficient market system. That's a kind of segue, which I hadn't, as I say, planned, which I'm improvising, from what Zoe Venn just said to what I think and hope, and why I'm here, this conference may contribute to. Andrew and in his different way, Nassim, and certainly Emmanuel Durbin have given some quite deep insight into what's going on in the micro foundations of thinking and modeling and theorizing about economic and financial behavior. Clearly, the work of Kahneman and Tversky, behavioral economics, is now becoming deeply embedded in the microeconomics of finance and economics and financial economics, which I have to say, as a fundamental Keynesian, I see as one discipline, not as two separate fields of study. Cumulative prospect theory, the notion of separating out a probability function from a value function, and observing how people seem to overweight low probability events, to me has always had a very deep, in thinking about the talk we just heard, very deep Darwinian roots. And in the informal way I would put it, if for millions of years, maybe at least the 22 million years, the upside has been that you have too much food to eat before it spoils, and too many mates available before you drop with exhaustion, and the downside is death, loss aversion would have evolutionary advantage. But I think that there's a lot of good work that the crisis is now giving moment to and giving visibility to. A lot of good work that is being done at MIT, at Princeton, at Yale, at Harvard. There are places all over, at Cambridge, I may say, at Oxford, at LSE. A lot of good work being done on the micro foundations. What I'm really interested in is extending from those micro foundations towards new macro theory, to dealing with what Nouriel attacked, I think, quite vividly in his characteristic style, real business cycle theory, which I think in the last 18 months served to create this kind of dead space, this latency between when it was clear we had a world-class financial crisis and credit crunch to when authorities and forecasters first began to recognize this was going to have very material macroeconomic consequences. If you actually track the mainstream macro forecast for GDP in 2009, they turned negative in December 2008. In other words, macroeconomic forecasters, almost all of whom were relying on DSGE models, were lagging indicators of economic performance. I think we've already seen how in the world, in financial economics, the micro foundations are generating the notion of endogenous bubbles and crashes within the financial markets. I think there's a coupling that needs to be done. It goes back to what happened to Keynes. Keynes wrote about how if it's cheaper to buy equity ownership in the market versus building something from scratch, there's an absolute obvious coupling between the financial markets and the, quote, real economy. When I was a kid in Wall Street, the way people put it was sometimes it's cheaper to drill for oil on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange than in the Gulf of Mexico. But more generally, let me just conclude with three quick thoughts. New micro foundations imply and perhaps even entail new macroeconomics. That's a big project. Second, endogenous bubbles. Let's be very careful about how we think about abolishing bubbles. It is, in fact, over the last 200 years, how a capitalist system driven by technological innovation has worked out how to mobilize the capital to build networks of infrastructure from canals through railroads to electrification to the internet before anybody knew what the return possibly could be on it, and then to fund a Darwinian explosion, a Cambrian proliferation of hopeful monsters about, you know, what to do with this new stuff. Out of 1,000 startups, you wind up with a Google and an eBay and an Amazon. So let's be careful about thinking about making things really boring. And then finally, the contribution of psychology and cognitive neuroscience to the micro foundations, in my view, needs to be substantially enhanced by drawing upon the rest of the social sciences, and for economists not only to think about what they can learn from the natural sciences, but to take seriously the notion that inevitably economics is and will be a social science. And anthropologists and sociologists, and in a world where there's a dynamic interaction between the market process and the political process, political scientists all are part of helping to understand the context in which the activity of human agents and their interactions in around the world of economics and finance take place.
Bill and Zoe, so now if other members of the panel want to comment, come in. Don't be shy. I see Andy getting ready to say something.
As an academic, I'm always ready to say something. So I guess, you know, let me just comment on the fact that there are a number of aspects of this financial crisis that we don't yet fully understand. And in keeping with the arguments that I made in my talk about the emotional state, when emotions run high, either too much fear or too much greed, we end up making decisions that may not be in our own best interest. And I think you can see this right now with some of the legislation that's coming through. There's legislation that's being formulated by politicians who are responding to their constituents. And right now, because of the fear, we're getting the madness of crowds. And a number of the policies that have been proposed by Congress and even through Treasury are being twisted by the political realities. And so I think it's just important to keep in mind that it's going to take some time for us to be able to think rationally, clearly, and insightfully about what we've experienced, and then to propose reasonable responses to that in the form of regulatory oversight. And I'm quite hopeful that we'll be able to do that, because if you ask the question, where did the regulatory infrastructure come from that we that brought us to this day, it was the regulatory infrastructure that was put in place in the 1930s and 40s in the aftermath of the Great Depression that ended up creating essentially 70 years of reasonable prosperity. And if we want to have another 100 years of additional prosperity, we need to take advantage of the opportunity now to create those kinds of new regulatory infrastructures.
Manuel?
I have some general remarks. I mean, I'm a bit of idealist at heart, which is why I went into physics. And what bothers me about what's going on now is that everybody's desperately trying to restore the status ante quo without ever thinking about what the world should be like. They just desperately hang on long enough, as somebody, I think Nouriel said this morning, places that are insolvent, people are hoping that if they can just delay insolvency for long enough, they'll turn into illiquidity, even if they're insolvent now. It's sort of a behavioral problem in the sense in behavioral finance, they tell you that if you're on the loss side, you'd like to be long volatility, and if you're on the winning side, you'd like to be short volatility. And right now, all the people that are on the losing side are hoping for as much time as possible to get for volatility to bring them back. Yeah. And anyway, I'm just distressed that there's not much discussion about, I mean, economics is political in the end, and there's not much discussion about what would be a good solution rather than how to simply get back to where we were.
Bill?
Yeah, I'm kind of chewing on this a little bit. I think one thing, we were talking about this at lunch, I think it's important to recognize that, like it or not, I mean, it feels like it's been forever since August 07. This is not very long. In the context of the last time round, from October 29, you know, we're now the winter of 30, 31, you know, spring of 31, getting into the summer of 31. Keynes published a treatise on money in late 1930, two enormous volumes. They were intended by him to be his masterwork on the history and then the theory of money in exchange systems, in financial and economic systems. They all assumed, I mean, his entire work assumed that all resources are fully employed at all times. He'd spent 5 years, 7 years working on this and woke up to discover that the most fundamental assumption that he'd made in what he thought was his masterpiece was factually incorrect. And that led him to start rethinking and rethinking and shooing away. And 5 years later, the general theory emerged. In terms both, so what I'm saying is that not just at the policy level, the level of policy response, I think we should be, frankly, we glad for lags and latencies and delay. In 1931-32, the dominant view in the legislature, not just in Washington, but in state legislatures, was the preferred response, the obvious response, was since the market was so bad at pricing securities, I mean particularly the overpricing of securities in the 29 boom, that the state should take on the responsibility and that new issues should in fact be priced to a fair value determined by, in the state of North Dakota, the Secretary of State of North Dakota. That's why there are blue sky laws and why when you're doing an initial public offering, the lawyers will tell you the states in which you better not sell a share of stock. In fact, it took another 2 years for a couple of really bright kids, the New Deal version of AB's Irish Rose, Ben Cohen and Tommy Corcoran, to convince the president that disclosure rather than diktat was the proper response. And I think anyone, Brownie might have some comments on the speed, the consequences of the speed with which Sarbanes-Oxley was passed after Enron and WorldCom and the bust, the tech bust. As a practitioner, I can say, I think that a little more thought and a year or two longer of reflection might have produced legislation and a regulatory framework that was more productive and more effective. So if we can survive this, I think taking a little time to absorb and learn and think about what's going on will not be a bad thing.
Okay, why don't we open it up at this point let's have short questions and short responses, and then we can have some interesting discussion. So who would like to? Yes.
I read your book and I really liked it. I actually have a copy of my own. And I remember that in your book you mentioned at some point you had interest in making the connection between the thermodynamics and financial economics theory. And in your talk today, you also make a little linkage between them. If I recall it correctly, that you mentioned even like probably entropy might be, you know, so similar to money or profit or whatever. So I just want to know after that whether you have any like deeper insight that you can share with us. Thank you. And also whether anything like developing physics in thermodynamics can be used like to this to explain this financial crisis. Thank you.
I wish I knew the answer, but it was only a facile analogy really, but when I came from physics to finance, the laws of no arbitrage always reminded me a little bit of the laws of the second law of thermodynamics, and a little bit of what Eric drew on the board, drawing different path diagrams in which a system could go in various ways, always reminded me of a Carnot cycle, and I always thought of dS, which is entropy, which is dQ over T in physics. It always reminded me of money. dQ always reminded me of money flow, and T always reminded me of risk, and it always looked to me to be some analogy, but I never figured out anything better than that. But I take credit from it for anybody who does.
Way over there.
Hi, this is Adar Abdullahi from Prodigy Partners. This is a question for Zoe. I just want to, you know, in defense of the fair market value part of the equation, the fundamental principle of accounting, or fundamental theory of or practice in GAAP of lower cost or market, or a transactional based using a transaction for valuation. How does that apply then to derivatives? Like if you do a credit default swap or a swap, the transactional price is zero, there's no cost, and you're sort of forced to go to fair market value. So how do you address that?
Well, remember what we're talking about here is sort of looking at the cash flows from the whatever the asset is or whatever the liability is. So we're thinking about what cash flows transpire from that.
Right, but I mean, so the theory of the swap, when you do a swap, the cash flows you're going to give out and get in exactly equal. So the mark-to-market is zero, so if you go to the cost or transaction-based, you get infinite leverage in the system, which might have been part of the problem in the accounting profession for, you know, why the leverage increased in the system by a huge amount.
Yeah, I think maybe there's a couple of different dimensions to this, and I don't know if we want to get down in the weeds or not here, but some of this will be about contingent liabilities and disclosures of potential contingencies that aren't captured necessarily under the accounting structure of actual that meet the probability assessments for an actual transaction to record. Others are recording, you know, the exchange price of them. So depending upon what you're talking about here, and then you know, there's just been a lot of problems with other areas that sort of off the books. That was a problem that we were supposed to have solved after Enron, and of course didn't get solved with a lot of these structured finance vehicles that are off the books. So if you kind of look at all of those areas, one of the global problems here with GAAP accounting is people argue it's becoming more pro-cyclical. So you sort of take your checklist of the issues that you want to bring up, and you can kind of go down the list, and they made things look better on the upside, and they make things look a lot sort of more dismal and dire on the worst, on the downside. So, you know, we can kind of debate the individual accounting techniques here, or for capturing individual transactions, but it's sort of the big picture here in terms of whether it's adequacy of reflecting the numbers and whether they have any meaningful sort of sense of what the expected cash flows are from that.
Can I also respond to that in a somewhat broader fashion? I want to make the observation that the language of accounting is extraordinarily useful for doing performance attribution on a retrospective basis. The idea behind accounting is to figure out, you know, how we made what money we made, how we lost what money we lost, and where our assets were and where there were not. Those are all concepts that are backward looking. But in fact, what the language of accounting has been used for by management is for engaging in strategic planning and forward looking. You're using a language that was not designed to be forward looking, to look forward. So to your point about the credit default swap, imagine a company that puts on a credit default swap that is twice the market cap of its current value, its balance sheet. The day that credit default swap gets struck, that swap has no market value. It's neither an asset nor a liability. So you know what? It doesn't go on the corporate balance sheet, but it sure does affect the risk of the company. And that's the difference between forward-looking and backward-looking. So I would argue that what we need to do is to develop a new branch of accounting called risk accounting, which is designed to be forward-looking, uses the language of probability and statistics, and really tries to capture exactly these issues in an explicit way, rather than to try to use a set of tools that was not designed to be forward-looking to do so.
Well, it's actually sort of interesting. Can I just add something here? Okay. You know, the efficient market hypothesis hasn't necessarily helped a whole lot in this regard in some ways, because there's this notion of when in doubt, just disclose. And we have a lot of disclosure here. So we have a lot of disclosure around some of the issues that you're talking about, whether they're the appropriate disclosures for making the kinds of assessments that you want to make. But when, you know, we're talking about, well, anyway, so the Andrew's right in the sense that what we're looking at is an accounting system for keeping track of things. But that also has predictive value. If you can get to the fundamentals of a company, it has great predictive value. So there's this paradox that it is backward-looking, but it's also incredibly forward-looking if you don't screw it up, in a sense. And that's one of the problems with fair value accounting. Some of us think we don't fully understand it yet, but we think it screws it up. That's a technical term, Lee.
Okay, we got, I think, yeah, and
I don't know about that other fancy stuff, but for 30 of the last 40 years, I was one of these management guys using this stuff. And I talked to the street for half of that time every quarter. And if here's a little bit of a problem you have if you start using different languages for looking forward and looking back, because when I talk to the street and tell them how to think about me looking forward, then next quarter when I get up to the forward I was talking about last quarter, if I don't measure it the same way that I talked about the quarter before, they don't have any idea how to connect between those two sets of dots. And so, you know, you do this over time, not all at once. And I found it was best to keep it very simple, let them do all the rest of their other thinking, and be careful not to let them run too far out ahead, and then be fully accountable the following quarters so they could go where we were. This was before there was guidance, and I liked it better before there was guidance because the analyst had to triangulate. In fact, we didn't even always agree in management what we thought would happen, and we usually gave them three stories with different possibilities, and they had to find a middle space and do their own work instead of just fill in their spreadsheets and, you know, push the button on their printer. So I like the old system a lot better than the one we have now, and unless I miss my guess, if we get back to sanity, we'll probably get back to some of these basics as well.
Brownie, of course, you're talking about a time when sell-side investment research was an honorable profession, and there actually were thoughtful professionals who were committed to doing that triangulation.
Matt?
I just wanted to say something with reference to Adil, in that I spent a couple of years trying to help people mark illiquid products at Goldman in the early 2000s. And we introduced the notion of not just the mark looking forward, but the uncertainty in the mark. And so every mark on an illiquid product that was marked to model also had to involve a model for estimating how uncertain you were if you couldn't get a bid on it. So we would sort of simulate hedging it to expiration under reasonable conditions and seeing how big the error in the P&L was. And so every mark essentially, this affected the company's P&L, but it affected traders' compensation too. Their mark came with an uncertainty which was held back until it was either realized or modified as time went on. And I think maybe that's what's partly missing, is that when you're looking forward, you don't actually know what the value is, and you can do a little bit better if you try to put the uncertainty in and hold it back. Hold it back meaning not let people get paid as a basis of it.
There's another thought that comes out of this. This question can live forever. And it has to do with the whole notion of the credit default swap. And I know two of the people who invented it at JPM are really quite good friends of mine. We've had a lot of conversation on this subject. So the credit default swap is, it's a form of insurance, right? I pay you a periodic payment, and if there is an event of default, now, you know, sort of more or less as defined, then you owe me the nominal value that I have taken out, you know, bought the insurance from you. So the original notion of moral hazard goes back several hundred years, 200, maybe even 250 years. Moral hazard was the term that was associated with the act of an individual in taking out an insurance policy on somebody else's house or life. And it came to be, in civil law, illegal for me to insure Andrew's house because that insurance policy gave me an incentive to burn it down. but also insured his life, I tried to do it when he was fast asleep. Now, a credit default swap is precisely, unless it is matched to a cash exposure, in other words, I own the bond, I own bonds issued by J.P. Morgan, and I buy an insurance policy to hedge against default. It is precisely the kind of instrument that was declared illegal in the insurance world by many, many lawsuits and legislation a couple of hundred years ago. And I sort of wrestled with it. Initially, I have to say, Ben Bernanke isn't alone. That was 5 years ago in 2004 when he said that credit default swaps, credit derivatives had distributed risk. Well, I don't know anybody who didn't think in 2004, when the total volume of credit derivatives were a small number of trillions of dollars, that they weren't distributing risk. By the time it got to 63 trillion, which is, by the way, where it peaked, and the daisy chain was going around so often, you knew that this was, the weakest link could produce catastrophe. But I think this I'd be interested, in fact, I'd be very interested in what both Emmanuel and Andrew think about sort of the substantive role, value, and almost existential risk associated with credit derivatives, naked credit derivatives.
I think that, in general, clearly derivatives are an important set of tools for individuals to manage their risks and their expected returns. So, what we have to worry about, I think, is the way that these derivatives are structured and how they grow so that they grow responsibly. I'll give you an example. There was a proposal that was made years ago that was ultimately shouted down by other regulators to create a credit default swaps exchange, like a futures exchange where you have standardized contracts, daily settlement, daily mark-to-market, and a clearing corporation that guaranteed performance for various different counterparties. So if we had a credit default swaps exchange, all of the problems that we've seen now in the credit derivatives markets, not the collateralized debt obligation market, that's a separate issue, but all of the credit derivatives would be fine. And we decided not to do that. We decided not to do that because there was a period of tremendous prosperity and success in markets, so that the regulators all basically said to this one lone voice, Brooksley Barnes, the head of the CFTC at the time, they said to her, "What's the matter with you? Why are you making trouble? Everything's just fine. Leave it alone. Don't rock the boat." And this is exactly the kind of false sense of complacency that extended periods of success can breed. So I would argue that there are a number of things that we can do now to fix those problems, and we should. But we have to deal, I think, ultimately with the human issue before we really resolve the problem of how to prevent these kinds of crises, which are inevitable, from being as disruptive as they are.
I don't have anything.
My name is Sasha Utkin. I'm from Santa Fe Partners. My question is about limits of probability and statistics in application to social systems. And so example here is this. So for example, if we're talking about a two-sided coin, in this case, we know for certain what the mechanism is which generates the probabilities. On the other side, when we're talking about social systems, we really don't know what's, even if we apply probabilistic description, say using historical data, we don't really know what the mechanism is which generates those probabilities. And furthermore, humans are a part of this mechanism by definition, because we are generating those probabilities. So my question is, if it's conceivable to think of events or maybe entire scenarios for which the probability distribution is simply doesn't exist before the fact, and after the fact it would be irrelevant in any case. And I'm sorry, actually, I think I'm echoed some of the things already said in the talks, but that's my question.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. I mean, I think people use probability in a very sloppy way, and the counting, I forget the adjective, there's an adjective that means essentially counting that people use for one kind of probability. And there's an interesting article by, I think, Daniel Friedman from Berkeley about what it means to say that the probability of an earthquake in California in the next 3 years is so much or so much. And he analyzes it very carefully and shows that it's based on I don't know, 50 different kinds of meanings of the word probability, including some models and some inputs. And it doesn't mean anything from the counting point of view at all. And secondly, I wanted to mention actually about behavioral finance and what I think drives even a deeper blow into this whole view of looking at an expected valuation of things is there's this famous paper by Ellsberg of the Pentagon Papers about the showing that people's, let alone behavioral finance, not representing the way people look at the world. There's some systems for which people just don't have consistent probabilistic views that satisfy the aims of the savage axioms of probability at all. And so expected value sometimes doesn't make any sense for people at all from an, I don't know whether from an evolutionary or from an intuitive point of view.
I just want to make one comment. I keep hearing questions which appear to be foundational questions for economics having to do with the meaning of probability. What is an observable and what are observables and what are probabilities carried out into the future, which are the same foundational problems that we worry about with respect to the foundations of quantum mechanics and cosmology and so forth. So I find that fascinating. There's a question over there. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Brett Weinstein. I'm an evolutionary biologist at the Evergreen State College. And I wanted to take a stab at trying to bring three of the talks together and actually some comments of Bill's as well, using a couple of dichotomies that I think might shed some light. So Emmanuel started with the question of how one can bridge the gap between science and economics, and he paints a picture of a very broad gap, which there is obviously a large gap there, but I wonder if maybe the gap is narrower than painted by virtue of the fact that finance and economics and engineering, which were the three things low on his list, are indeed very far from physics and chemistry because physics and chemistry have no purposefulness in them. There's no better particle or worse particle. But that doesn't mean that science lacks any model system. Within biology, we have something that if it isn't purpose, it's very close to it, close enough that it provides proper analogies. And so the gap getting from science to economics is only as far as the gap between the purposefulness of living organisms and their parts and things like economics. But that involves understanding exactly what it is that the purpose underlying evolved creatures is. And so one part of this comes directly from Andrew's talk. He did a very good job of talking about heuristics and the fact that the brain takes shortcuts to get places, and that is indeed one place that we are likely to find the roots of economic error, but it's not the only place. The other likely place is that errors made by thinking creatures like ourselves are very likely in circumstances when those thinking creatures are living outside what we evolutionists would call the environment of evolutionary adaptedness. And so it is not only the simplifications of the brain, but it is also the fact that our brains are trying to keep pace with an environment that has shifted radically, in fact, several times in the last 30,000 years. Anyway, my suggestion is that we should group those sciences in which we can talk intelligently about purpose together, which puts evolutionary biology over with economics, rather than trying to get all the way from physics, and that once we get to evolutionary biology, that we distinguish between errors that arise out of simplifying heuristics and errors that arise out of the novelty of the environment we currently exist in.
I'd like to follow up on that. I think that's a great observation, and in a way, I think it touches also upon some of Professor Alexander's comments that I want to come back to. I think that the distinction that you're making can also be made regarding the underlying phenomenon that the particular science is meant to study. So physics and chemistry are studying physical objects, whereas biology, evolutionary biology, economics, anthropology, they're studying biological objects. And while you can have the same scientific method applied to all of these endeavors, the nature of the science that comes out or the insights that come out will be fundamentally different because what you're studying is different. You know, F equal MA doesn't change depending on what day of the week you measure it or whether you measure it after a holiday or before. But the stock market's volatility certainly does. You're measuring a different object, and therefore one shouldn't take the look and feel of one science and expect to see it in another science, even though you apply the same scientific methods. The other point that you made I thought was an excellent one having to do with selection. And this goes back to a point that Professor Alexander made about lengthening one's lifespan and how one might go about doing it. And you know, I was hoping actually to ask him to comment on something that has to do with technology and the role that technology plays in our ability to kill so many of our, you know, fellow members of the species. In Jared Diamond's book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, he points out that technology, in particular steel, plays a very big role in certain societies flourishing and others being decimated. And one of the things that differentiates us from other mammals and other species is the fact that we have developed an ability to use technologies that, in my opinion, outstrip our ability to use them responsibly. One example of that is that my 8-year-old is having a birthday. He's going to be 9 at the end of this month, and he's planning his birthday party. And I asked him what he'd like for his friends and at this party to play with. And he told me that he'd really like to have a chainsaw because, you know, he saw me use one to clear the garden, and it works incredibly well. And so I thought about it for a moment, the vision of, you know, 10 8-year-olds, each with chainsaws, going after each other, you know. And it occurred to me that, in a way, that's sort of what Homo sapiens is today. We have financial chainsaws, we have nuclear chainsaws, we have chemical chainsaws that we may or may not ultimately be able to manage. And so it seems to me that this selection process is something we ought to pay a lot more attention to, particularly as it interacts with technology, and would love to get Professor Alexander's view about that.
What was that adverb you used back there when you said that we went past something? Sorry.
It's hard to
hear. You said we went too far.
It outstripped our ability to use the technology responsibly?
Yeah. How do you define responsibly?
Well, in terms of the probability of survival, that's how I would define it.
Well, are you responsible when you win a war and not responsible when you lose a war? I don't understand exactly what you meant.
My focus is really on the preservation of the species, so the question of survival ultimately, that we now have technologies that are capable of actually extinguishing the human population, and that's frightening.
Yeah, we talk about that all the time, but I almost want to finish the sentence by saying, but we really don't do a whole lot about it.
Right.
Yeah.
Last question. I'm sorry for people. Time is going on. Bill, before that, do you want to just comment on this? And then
why don't we take the question and see if it's relevant, and if not, I'll be irrelevant at the end.
Good. Okay. Point reserved. Okay. Go ahead.
My name's Chris Smith, and a couple times over today, and in particular, Andrew, in your example with the CDS regulator being told, I pretty much think, go away, we're having fun. And then your example with your son who wanted a chainsaw, and pretty much the argument was, go away, I'm having fun. I thought it was well established that high risk and high return strategies often went hand in hand. If we're forgetting that, we have another patch job to do on top of the one we're already attempting.
You're right that there is a tendency over a long history of time for high risk strategies to generate high returns. But what I was referring to was actually the human element of that equation. While it's true that high risk and high return go hand in hand, it's not at all the case that the human tolerance for that high risk is same throughout business cycle peaks and troughs. For example, right now, I would argue that most individuals are highly risk averse. much more so than they were, say, 18 months ago. And I would argue at the peak of the internet bubble, most individuals were pretty much risk insensitive. You know, to them, an investment in a company that has no earnings, that has no business, that has nothing, was a perfectly reasonable thing to do in 1999. And now, you can't get anybody to invest in companies that have billions of dollars of earnings. So I think that risk perception changes through time, also as a function of one's emotional state. And I think that's something that we ought to capture in our economic models, and we don't at this point.
So that could not be more relevant. In conversation with Eric, since I first walked in on his alpha versus schmalpha talk at the Quant Congress 5 years ago or so, one of the things I've kept sort of pointing out is exactly this point about that Andrew made, that the object of analysis here are conscious, aware human beings who are, among other things, aware of what they don't know and of the limits of their own models. And I had come up with a notion, I spent about 10 years trying to find a source for a quote, and having failed completely, I've decided that I'm the source of the quote, which is that natural scientists make theories about things, social scientists make theories about things that make theories. And when I was trying, along the way, I tried this out in my search for the source with a great friend of mine named Mike Godfrey, who did his doctorate under Oscar Morgenstern at Princeton. And Mike couldn't come back to me with that source, but he did come back. This is called the appeal to authority. He did come back to me with a quote. Quote, "It is unlikely that a mere repetition of the tricks which served us so well in physics will do for the social phenomena too." John von Neumann. So that's a caveat for the challenge involved in thinking how to bring the tools developed for physics, so advanced as they are, into addressing the social phenomena.
Thank you very much. I think we're out of time. I think that's a perfect bookmark. I don't know if you planned it to my starting off invoking Johnny von Neumann.
I brought it with me from New York.
I want to thank the audience for this has been a long day with a lot of ideas, a lot of intensity. So I'd like to thank the audience for coming and participating. And I'd like to thank our speakers, our panel, our organizing committee. And thank you very much.